You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, we're going to go ahead and get started here for this second de-churching session. If you weren't here before, I'm Michael Graham. I'm the program director for the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics. That's just a fancy way to say we make R&D type resources for the church. So this second talk, how many of you, just by a show of hands, are into like history and the history of philosophy and thinking? Okay, all right. That's why there's fewer people at this one than the last one. So what we're going to talk about here during this session is going to be, how do we get here? Okay, in other words, what's the backstory for, you know, all this de-churching stuff? Now, in our last session, we kind of talked about this from kind of the 1990s onward. But really, there's actually a storyline here that goes back several hundred years, all the way back to the Enlightenment. And so what I want to do is do a fast-paced, several hundred-year kind of trace of de-churching, philosophically, from kind of the Enlightenment all the way up to today. And so bear with me. There'll be certain parts of this that you'll be maybe more into and other parts that you'll be less into, but I guarantee that there's going to be some things that you're like, man, that was really interesting. Okay, so stick with me. In the late 1800s, there was a founder of the entire field of sociology named Max Weber, and he wrote this book that was really influential entitled The Rise of Protestantism in the Spirit of Capitalism. I don't know, something of that sort. I think I butchered that. But here's the point. The first half of the book, he makes this point. Capitalism never existed in the world until the Puritans. And the reason why is because the Puritans in America had two qualities about them that no other group of people had ever had before. And the two qualities are this. Their otherworldliness, in other words, they were living for another world. They were living for the kingdom. And then their view that work was worship. And so what happens when you have a group of people who view work as worship, but they're not living for the here and now, but they're living for a future kingdom, is they end up amassing capital and not spending it. And that had never happened in human history before because humans don't like to delay gratification, and they don't necessarily like to just kind of do those things. And so capitalism had never been created as a system before. And so the Puritans accidentally created capitalism because primarily of their Calvinistic theology. And so what he goes and talks about in the second half of that book was he talks about how capitalism became an iron cage for the Puritans. And that within four generations of them accidentally creating capitalism, capitalism became a kind of replacement god for their former faith. You know, if you recall from our last talk, so much so that by 1776, only 17% of people in the colonies were attending church. That's a third the rate of people's church attendance here today. Now, what was happening at that same time in Europe was this. Europe was, you know, we've gone through the Renaissance has occurred, and that, you know, kind of the epicenter of that in Florence. And so there's all sorts of renewed thinking, art, all sorts of new ideas are being engaged with. And some of the things that are being engaged with are particularly stuff like scientific rationalism. In other words, how can we employ the five senses that we've been given to understand our world better and better and better and better? And I love science. I'm a huge nerd, math and science nerd, and I like history too, so it's the whole trifecta. And I do think that science and faith actually go fairly well together. That doesn't mean that there's not friction, you know, at points, but that's another conversation for another time. But here's the point. If all that we can know about the world comes only through the five senses, there's a lot of stuff in the world that we can't know. But we all know that there's more to existence than just the five senses. It's not just what's imminent. We all know this. We know, you know, Pascal said the heart has reasons that the mind knows nothing of. We all know that there's something more transcendent about not just our world, but the vastness of our universe. We know that there's something more that's there. And so the problem with the Enlightenment is that it was trying to have a total view of knowledge and understanding of everything in existence, but it was trying to do so with a tool set that was too small. And so the Enlightenment project ultimately failed because it was trying to create something, create an understanding of something that it could never, it didn't have the tools and the faculties that it needed to be able to understand everything that it was trying to understand. And so what happened with the failure of the Enlightenment project, you know, hundreds of years later, and again, in the last, you know, 100 years or so, we end up in this period of what is called post-modernity or late modernity. And that created for people cynicism, skepticism, disillusionment, disenchantment. And so we're dealing with the impact of the failure of the Enlightenment project because it's something that could never the Enlightenment project overpromised and it underdelivered. So the problem wasn't necessarily science. Science is good, you know. We ought to be doing these things. But it's like it was trying to produce something that it was never going to have the ability through its own faculties to be able to create. And so the Enlightenment created a lot of challenges for the church. And so it created critiques for the institutional church. It also accelerated the fracturing of the church in the West. We've talked about this before. The first Great Awakening occurred even before the Revolutionary War and the Declaration of Independence. We were even less churched than what we were in 1776 before the first Great Awakening. The story that I was told in the kind of circles that I grew up in, which trended fundamentalist, was basically that, well, all these people came over from Europe, primarily from the UK. They came over for religious freedom. America was a very religious society, and we've basically been in like a 250-year decline from the peak of our founding. And it's just probably a story that really just isn't supported by either the history or the data. The story's a lot more complicated than that. And so, but the Puritans had become so deconstructed by the capitalism that they accidentally created that the first Great Awakening was necessary just to bring America to a place of being 17% churched in 1776, okay? And so it's important to understand, like, this is all downstream from the Enlightenment project, and perhaps the single most important thing in the Declaration of Independence was one really important edit that was made there. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. That was Jefferson who wrote that, but that wasn't Jefferson's first drafting of that sentence. Do you know what the first drafting of the sentence said? It said, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." But an edit was given by Benjamin Franklin to remove that language was too religious for him, and he said, let's just go with self-evident. And so in many ways, the Declaration of Independence and kind of some of our founding documents, when you compare them even to the charters that were happening at the various state levels, you know, you can look at like the Connecticut and other charters, they explicitly mention the gospel of Jesus Christ as part of, you know, kind of the founding of that particular state or colony. And so our founding documents are in many ways watershed moments into secularism in America. So secularism is not something that's just like a last 50 years or last 100 years thing. This is something that's kind of been baked in really since 1776. Now, let me say this. That's on one side. Let me say the flip side of this. When you look at Europe, every country that has had state-based religion in Europe, it has not gone well. Not one. So in some ways, even with some of the removal of some of that kind of religious language from our founding documents, maybe was probably actually a mercy to us to have distance between government and the church. Because when the problem is when you have state-based religion, is when one of those two institutions does something bad or does something poorly, it can have spillover effects onto the other. And we all know that given enough amount of time, the government's going to behave in a way that's going to be problematic, or people are going to struggle. Okay, all right, so this is what the rates of church attendance has looked like over the course of U.S. history. So right here is 1776, this next one is 1850, 1860, 1870. The fastest growth of being churched is the gap between 1870 and 1890. That's the 20 years after the Civil War, for obvious reasons. And then we get all the way up to peak churching in roughly the 70s and 80s. Scholars disagree a little bit on, this figure. It varies between 62 and 70%. But that gives you a sense of just kind of the history of churching in America. Today, it's a little under 50% in the mid to high 40s. All right. The Revolutionary War created a lot of interesting things from the history of ideas in our country. If you remember, again, Jefferson spent a lot of time in France. And so when he went over and spent a lot of time in France, he brought a lot of ideas back to him. He was, back into America, and a lot of those ideas basically trickled down, particularly throughout elite intellectual circles in New England. And so even at that time already, and I believe all but one of our Ivy League schools did begin as seminaries. So that's important to remember that all but one of those were religious institutions at one point in time. But even at this time in 1776, there was no belief left at Yale at that time. So here's the landscape from a denominational standpoint in 1776. There's three denominations among Christianity in America that totally dominated: Congregationalists, Episcopalians, and Presbyterians, CEP. Those three denominations comprised 55% of all the people who were church-going, okay? By 1850, that 55% goes all the way down to 19%. 55% down to 19%. And at the same time, in 1776, 19% of Americans were either Baptist or Methodist. And by 1850, that 19% Baptist and Methodist become 55% Baptist and Methodist by 1850, right before the Civil War. And so it's really, really important that we understand what happened denominationally that Congregationalists, Episcopalians, and Presbyterians declined so rapidly, and why did Baptists and Methodists grow so rapidly? That story is relevant to how we think about kind of the religious landscape, how we get, the various different denominations, and some of the different movements of things here today. So bear with me, because I actually think this is like some of the more interesting stuff. Okay, all right. So huge market share increases, 1776, 1850. Yep, covered that. So look at this. Congregationalists were 20% in 1776. By 1850, 4%. Episcopalians, 16 down to 3.5%. Presbyterians, they held on a little bit better, 19 down to 12. Baptists went from 17% to 21%. And look at this. Look at the Methodists. 2.5% up to 34%. There. The Roman Catholics rose precipitously as well from 2% to 14%, but that was primarily through ethnic-based immigration.
So I'm going to gloss over that part. Also, that's the AME Church in America. So if you don't, does anybody know the history of the AME Church? Do I need to rehearse that here? Sounds like I do. All right, so white churches were denying communion and other things to black congregants in churches. And so the founders of the AME Church, the black church had to be formed so that people could hear the gospel and be administered the so black people could be hear the gospel and be administered the sacraments. And so you see a massive rise, obviously, in the AME Church there during those years. The bottom left there is 1790, and the far right is 1850. Okay, so we've covered this idea that basically the Baptists and Methodists rise. Now, here's what happened. The Congregationalists, Episcopalians, and Presbyterians, they had a very formal and rigid sense of what it meant to be a minister and what it meant to start a church in those denominations. All of your clergy had to be theologically trained, and every church needed to have their own building and, physical structure associated with them. The Baptists and Methodists had a different perspective. And what neither of those two traditions had an expectation for theological education. Theological education was actually, in many ways, discouraged. And neither of them had a path to doing church in a physical structure. So typically what was happening around this, between 1776 and 1850, was basically you had a lot of basically circuit riding, itinerant preaching, and these would often happen in people's barns, in people's fields, in people's homes, in public, town squares, these different kinds of things. And it wasn't uncommon for a circuit rider to have as many as 20 churches to which they were personally responsible for. Do you know what's interesting is this? Do you know what the life expectancy of a 1800s era circuit rider was in either the Baptist or Methodist tradition? Their life expectancy was 30 years old. So imagine, being a church planter who's responsible for 20 churches and doing it all on horseback. Not necessarily a recipe for, OSHA and, life of longevity. But when you imagine having 20 churches that are being planted and pastored by a single person and that whose overhead financially is almost zero, it's just basically the cost of that circuit rider. Imagine that as a unbelievably viral church planting strategy. And that's what happened with the frontier of, not the coastal, that's not what was happening in the coastal, especially the New England, areas. But when we're talking about the areas of the Western movement of, as settlement was kind of moving from the original 13 colonies further westward. Okay, so the thing that I'm Baptist, so I can be self-deprecating here. The thing that the Congregationalists, Episcopalians, and Presbyterians were highly susceptible to some of the errors that were coming across the Atlantic. Around the same time in the middle of the 1800s, what was happening was higher and lower textual criticism. And a lot of this was coming out of Germany, and there were a lot of questions about, well, is the Bible reliable? What about all of these, these challenges or these inconsistencies? And without getting into the nitty-gritty of higher and lower textual criticism, a lot of was kind of being deconstructed about, can we take the Bible seriously? And what is the relationship between the Bible and science? Okay? And so a lot of those ideas were coming across the Atlantic, and they were going into a lot of these elite institutions, particularly your your Ivy League institutions and some of the seminaries that were in New England. And so these ideas begin to trickle down. And so when you have denominations that are hierarchical and institutional, they're more susceptible because of the chain of command to being those errors being more rapidly diffused throughout that structure and that system. Okay? So imagine, you know, if you have two mounds of dirt, and one is really steep, like this, and then you have another mound of dirt that's you know, very, you know, much more flat. Water is going to flow over the one that's more, you know, that has the steeper shape to it versus the other one. And so this is what happened kind of amongst Congregational, Episcopal, and Presbyterian circles throughout that 1776 to 1850, as these ideas from higher and lower textual criticism were working their way into the institutions of higher learning and down to the bishops, and then the bishops down to the various parishes. And so the end result of all of that, the flip side of that was, so this is where I'm going to make fun of Baptists as one. What saved Baptists and what saved Methodists was the lack of institutional hierarchy, the idea among Baptists in particular that every local church is autonomous, and the fact that that Baptists were not theologically trained and there weren't seminaries that they were going to, there was nobody to come and share those ideas with them. So in other words, what saved the Baptists and the Methodists in the middle of the 19th century was essentially their ignorance. So I'm not saying that's a good thing. It's just a historical reality. And the thing that really hurt those other denominations was the amount of overhead and expenses that it took to start a new church. Just imagine the economics of this. You're a Baptist itinerant circuit riding preacher, and you're responsible for 20 churches, okay? Do you know what the Episcopal priest in any of the coastal cities made in terms of salary relative to yours? 6 times as much. Okay? Just like the inequity of like how hard you're working and the pay. It's really unbelievable. So this is why the Baptists and Methodists and the Congregationalists, Episcopalians, and Presbyterians flip-flop from that 55 to 19 in that 74-year time period. So now what happens later, though, is the Baptists end up taking over from the Methodists. This is important to understand because this is how we get into non-denominationalism in America in not too long. So what happened among the Methodists is, you got to remember, the Methodists were downstream from the Church of England. And the Church of England was hierarchical. And Methodists, unlike Baptists, believe that every local church is autonomous. Methodists do not. And so Methodism was a little bit more susceptible to some of the same challenges that the Congregationalists, Episcopalians, and Presbyterians had. And so secularization was largely on the rise. So one of the challenges that mainline Protestantism has I'm maybe getting a little ahead of myself here, but if you were an American in kind of the post-war consensus America, you know, middle of the 20th century, and you valued pluralism, you know, live and let live, you know, with your neighbors, let ideas, you know, kind of run, you know, in the marketplace of ideas, the better ideas float, the worse ones sink. You know, let's be good to each other, you know, let's take care of each other, so on and so forth. Mainline Protestantism didn't have enough difference between its values and the values of just being a regular American. In other words, mainline Protestantism was so successful in America that it was almost synonymous with being American. And as a result of that, there wasn't enough difference between it and the rest of culture and society for it to survive. Because eventually people were just like, well, the values are the same for culture and society as at church, so why do I need church anymore? So there's this balance in contextualization. As we, so there's the positions that we hold, and then there's the posture with which we hold those positions. And this is contextualization, right? So there's the ideas that we have, and then the way that people, how do we make people feel? And so there's always this balance of being over-contextualized and under-contextualized. Let me give you an analogy. Did anybody here run track? Anybody? Just a couple people. Okay. All right. The people who love who've ran track, all right, you'll be dialed in for this. I was a middle distance runner, primarily 800 to 5,000. But one of the things that was always interesting to me was the 400 meter hurdles. And in the 400 meter hurdles, how many hurdles are there on the track? Somebody tell me. Come on, y'all. It's 10. It's always 10. It's same in the 100 or the 110 meter hurdles too. It's always 10 hurdles, okay? Here's what contextualization is. Proper contextualization is 10 hurdles on the track. Okay, here's what the hurdles represent. The hurdles represent all of the hard things that are actually in the text as it pertains to the cost of discipleship. That's what the hurdles are, okay? Under contextualization is when we say, let's start with over-contextualization. Over-contextualization is when we get embarrassed about the cost of discipleship and the offense of the gospel. And we start to take some of those 10 hurdles off the track. And maybe we go from 10 hurdles on the track down to 6. Oh, I'm really embarrassed about that one thing that we have in our ethical system. And so maybe let's just take that off the track, you know? And that's what was happening, you know, among mainline Protestants was over-contextualization. Mainline Protestants were over-contextualized. And they were, in taking those hurdles off the track, there wasn't enough difference between mainline Protestantism and the rest of American culture and society. Under-contextualization is when you start adding hurdles onto the track. So, okay, you got to vote this way. You got to have, you got to dress like this. You've got to do, you got to perform, perform these things to the, to the conformity of this, this group of people. You got to be tribal in ways A, B, and C. Okay? Those are things that aren't actually in the text, and what we're expecting people to jump over those things in order to be accepted by us in our local churches. And so what we want to do, and is always proper contextualization. And that just means 10 hurdles on the track. So when people are being offended by the gospel, let it only be the 10 things that are actually in the text. Let's not let them be offended by things that we've added, or let's not let them think that there isn't a particular cost to something that is actually a cost. And so what happened from the Methodists is, and it was slower than the Congregationalists, Episcopalians, and Presbyterians, was not that different than what was happening among other kind of mainline Protestant groups. And that was, there just wasn't enough difference between the values that were there and the broader culture and society. And so it was that over-contextualization and some of the removing of some of the actual offense of the gospel that's there in the text. And so, and again, at the same time, itinerant preachers were dismounting, so the rate of rapid expansion significantly slowed. It's understandable if that was your job. You'd want to, can I just pastor one church in that 20? And then the Methodists eventually had kind of rising theological liberalism that was coming over from Europe. and covered this already. They were, you know, the Baptists were resistant to all of this, primarily through their ignorance, through their the independence of their congregation, regional differences, those kinds of things. Okay, where did the non-denominational thing start? This is wild. You ready? It started in 1912. This is a mouthful. The second quadrennial convention of the Federal Council of Churches. So they had a problem at this conference. So this is a bunch of church leaders from, you know, different denominations, and they're all getting together. And they had a big problem on their hand. We had too many rural churches. And the problem was overchurching. And so what did they decide? How are they going to deal with this overchurching thing? Quote, "The way to eliminate extra churches was to merge them into non-denominational Protestant community churches." And what types of churches were dominating this kind of rural landscape at that time in 1912? Somebody tell me. Baptists. Okay, you guys remember the Scooby-Doo episodes? You know what I'm talking about? You know, it's like, oh, it's the lighthouse guy. You know, you pull off the mask and it's always the lighthouse keeper. So, you know, it's kind of like Scooby-Doo with, like, when you go to a non-denominational church and you pull off the hood, what do you realize what's underneath? It's a Baptist church. So this is where like the just kind of the overlap between kind of how that history kind of formed. It's because of this overchurching thing, and you merge all these different Protestant churches together, and really what comes out, you know, after everything gets merged is like, well, it's kind of a Baptist church, you know. Okay. All right, so I'm not going to get into all that. Okay, the fundamentalist modernist controversy is really interesting in the history of religion in the United States. This is important for us to understand because I feel like we're kind of in a very similar moment to this. So this is like the 1920s to like 1950s here in America. And so as these ideas are coming over from Europe that are really, really challenging the Bible, and as they're challenging the Bible, they're challenging the person and work of Jesus. And as they're challenging the person and work of Jesus, it's challenging the resurrection. There's challenges from science, all of these. And then what comes from after you deal with all of that is like, well, the morality stuff just starts to fall apart, okay? And it's no great surprise that, like, after the fundamentalist modernist controversy is largely over, what happens in the United States? The sexual revolution. So there's a lot here from a history standpoint that it's important for us to understand of, like, the interplay between conversations that were happening in, you know, kind of obscure churches and seminaries and these different kinds of things. It ends up having really significant impact on American culture and society at large. And so, but what happened in the fundamentalist modernist controversy is you have three reactions to all of these challenges to the Bible and to Jesus and to the resurrection and to our ethical system. And the three responses were, on the one hand, a movement to the right of fundamentalism. Okay, and we're going to recede from culture and society. We're just going to form purely, you know, alternative communities, and the relationship, the posture that we're going to have towards broader culture and society is going to be one of antagonism and under-contextualization. On the other side of things, you had the modernists, and the impulse there was to over-contextualization. Okay, people are struggling with these ideas. Let's just soft play or remove some of the, you know, let's just take some of those barriers out of the way for people. And the problem is both of those things were erroneous and they didn't play out well. But what got birthed out of the fundamentalist modernist controversy was a middle path between both of them. And do you know what the label is for that third path that was neither this nor this? Evangelicalism. Okay? That's where evangelicalism is birthed out of, the fundamentalist modernist controversy. which a lot of it is non-denominational. Okay, you see, am I starting to connect some dots? Are we connecting dots here? Are we having a good time? Yeah? Are we awake? Not hypoglycemic after lunch? Okay. Yeah, we kind of covered this a bit, but just the mainline decline, there just wasn't enough, there just wasn't enough distance there. Immigration brought some new religions, creep of, you know, new age stuff, theological liberalism, secularism, the growth of evangelicalism. Can you guys, though, see, I want to fast forward from, like, that time 7,500 years ago to right now. Don't you kind of see this happening again? You know, it's like, okay, we have rising secularism, rising sexual revolution, all sorts of, you know, evangelicals, even, you know, this group of people is beginning to really kind of fracture in a number of different ways. And you can kind of see, like, the people who are like, man, give me a strong man, you know? Give me somebody who I can latch on to. Let's get a government, you know, going that's, you know, that's for us, you know, and maybe people, maybe not Christian nationalists, but maybe they're adjacent to that. You know, let's go to war with the culture, you know, kind of thing. And then over here, you can kind of see, you know, the kind of mentality of, oh my gosh, these church people, they are terrible. And they, you know, they have done all this bad in the world and everything in the world. We can just put it, you know, we're just going to put it on them, you know. It's like that one passage in the scripture where it's like the Pharisees looking down at this person over here, like, I'm praising the Lord that I'm not like this, you know, Christian nationalist, you know, January 6th guy over here, you know. And so there's that. So you can kind of see that there's a kind of, it feels like there's like a once in a generation or once in a, you know, 50-100 year kind of thing that we're kind of going through again, where there's a danger on, you know, going this over-contextualization path again, and there's a danger here on this under-contextualization path. We've kind of already done this before, and we know that, like, neither of those paths are really going to work out so well, and we just kind of need to stay the course with and stay close to the text and not play this thing out again. So I'll send this. Look, and if any of you sent me an email or from that first thing, I'll send you all three of these presentations. You don't have to email me three times to this end. Look at this stuff. This is crazy. Let's look at the Methodists, and because they didn't start out so bad, but like 60%, I know God. This is, what year is this? What's this from? This survey was, yeah, 1965. Okay, so only 60% say I know God really exists. I have no doubts about it. Jesus is the Son of God. 54%. Jesus will actually return to the earth someday. 21%. But look at the ignorant Southern Baptists over here. They're like 99% on like almost everything, you know. But can you? It's hard because it's frustrating because it's like I value education, you know. And maybe I'm not like the most Baptist-y Baptist, but it's like, I don't know. There is a reality to when we cannot stray from the Bible, and we cannot stray from the historic creeds and confessions of the church. When we do, it goes really poorly. Now, when you're looking at these traditions here, okay, the United Church of Christ is almost non-existent today. The Methodists have seen an over 60% decline. It's going to accelerate, especially for the non-global Methodists. The Episcopalians have lost 70%. Disciples of Christ are like mid-60s. The PCUSA, which, so the PCA is conservative on the gender and sexuality piece. The PCUSA is not. The USA has lost over 70%. Anyways, you can go right on down the line. The groups that have strayed from the Bible from the creeds and confessions of the church and or on ethics, it hasn't gone well. And I don't know,
You know, I've been, you know, talking about this stuff has brought me into a lot of these, I've spoken to a lot of these different denominations and been in rooms with a lot of, you know, some of these denominations, especially among the Episcopal Church. I'm like, can anybody help me understand, like, now that, you know, now that we have like 50 years worth of data of decline, like, can anybody agree with me here? Even if you don't like agree on the ethics, but this was like a bad strategy. Like, this wasn't a good game plan. And particularly, and as it pertains to like, and I didn't know any of this before doing this research, you know, I was just a pastor. You know, only 6% of Americans self-identify as gay. Or sorry, 2% are just only gay, and 6% gay or lesbian, and then 6% bisexual. And it's like, this wasn't a good strategy for, you know, just tactically, you know, regardless of what you think about the text, and I think the text is very clear, it wasn't well thought out. And so, I don't know, I don't understand why the capitulation on these things. Okay, so yeah, you can see the numbers, they're terrible. You know, these numbers for the, you know, the mainline are terrible. And then you see at the same time, you know, tremendous growth among evangelicals, 37% Southern Baptist, 1,300% Kojic, AOG, 221%, Pentecostal Assemblies, World of God, 2,400%, Church of God, 500%, and then the main, you know, just dramatic mainline decline. All right, so it is relevant in American culture and society that during the kind of post-war consensus period in America, in the middle of the 20th century, you know, it's no mistake that we got In God We Trust, On Our Money, and Under God Added to Our Pledge. You know, call it what you will. I mean, that's political propaganda, and it was meant to, you know, basically create a foil of American, you know, Americans are religious and Christian, and our enemies are the opposite of those things. And so to be American meant to be, you know, faith was a piece of that, even though it was really civil religion, as opposed to like a heart, you know, a heart religion. So we kind of talked about this in terms of the atheist communist piece, but the rise of birth control and the sexual revolution, those two things are hand in glove, and we're still dealing with the implications of the sexual revolution today. I don't know what happens from here. I think in many ways, the transgender conversation was probably a bridge too far for most normie Americans. And so I think we're starting to, maybe for the first time in American culture and society, begin to see the pendulum begin to swing back a little bit. Some people have referred to that as the vibe shift. I'm not sure how that plays itself out. But there's certainly, we have not found the end of that conversation yet, and I don't know what that means for us in terms of the fracturing of, you know, American culture and society, but I still think the sexual revolution is bearing fruit, and I don't know how it will play itself out, but certainly it will not be boring, and it will be complex. All right, the rise of dechurching can largely, the time frame is probably Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. I do think that the most prophetic lyric of the entire 1990s was this one, "Here we are, now entertain us." And I think that lyric has really kind of been bearing itself out. I think about that lyric a lot. You know, initially it was, you know, cable television, and then it was the internet, Web 1, then it was the social, Web 2, the social internet, and then, you know, now it'll be like the era of AI slop and generative AI and, you know, all that, and we'll get, what's your name? Yeah,
Matt. Within 5 years, I'll be able to say, like, you know, hey, GPT, hey, Gemini, make a buddy, a 90s era buddy movie that's 90 minutes long, rated PG-13, you know, of a road trip of me and Matt through the Midwest with all sorts of hijinks, you know. And by 5 p.m. that night, it'll be ready, you know, on my whatever, on my Apple TV. So that's where the future is going. We're not even going to be, people won't even be able to have common touch tones of like movies and stuff because everything is getting niched down to the individual in this new era. And so we're just finding a, you know, new ways for us to just recede further and further into our individual selves, isolated from the institutions and the forces of, and this is what, I mean, it's just radical individualism, right? This is, you know, where for most of human history, how we understood ourselves and how we understood identity was by people external to us helping us, you know, name us, show us who we are, and hold up mirrors to us to basically say, oh, Mike, you know, you are this, you would be good at this, you should do these things, as opposed to now where the source of truth is not external to you, the source of truth is within. And that's a real tyranny, you know, because I think about the Taylor Swift, NYU, her speech there for the commencement address, and where she told everybody that, you know, hey, I got good news for you. You know, your future is up to you. Your identity is up to you. You know, like, go out there, you know, and make something amazing. Here's the problem with that story. One, it's not really true. But two, if it were true, what happens if you don't like your story? Whose fault is it? It's your fault. If you're the author of your own story and you don't like it, then the problem is you. You can see through music a lot of the rising disenchantment, disillusionment, discontentment. You know, I think about Rage Against the Machines, 1992 self-titled album. If there's a lot of language in there that's really interesting. But if you go and listen to that, it'll feel very much like 2020 or 2021. And so what I want to tell you is there's nothing new under the sun. And if you think something's new today, it probably isn't. And so you can go back to, you know, some of Public Enemy's records. You can think about REM's Losing My Religion. Those are all things that were in the water. And, like, I mean, this is just like, you know, run-of-the-mill MTV in their, you know, the first half of the 90s. Okay, we're at time. All right, high-speed internet, big deal. With Google, guess what? When you're a teacher, you no longer have a knowledge advantage over your kids. And in the era of generative AI, oh man, good luck. My wife's a school teacher. Y2K, Columbine, Iraq, Afghanistan, you had the rise of new atheism, which is no longer really with us. We had the Spotlight Roman Catholic Boston Diocese thing. We had the 2019 Texas Chronicle about the 700 cases in the SBC. Huge developments on sexuality. You know, Will and Grace 98, Bishop Eugene Robinson in the Episcopal Church, the Obergefell ruling, the T in the LGBT, the ubiquitousness of digital porn and particularly addiction. And that's not just a male thing, that's a male and female thing. Financial developments, yeah, the subprime mortgage collapse, the Great Recession, Occupy Wall Street, the Great Financial Crisis, all the ups and downs with the interest rates. You could add Liberation Day or whatever and the, you know, onto that. You know, dad's 401k became a 201k. Look at all these developments in, you know, in technology these last several years too. All these things happened, you know, in the last 20 years. all of this ends into a place where, you know, culture and society is in a place of disillusionment, discontentment, and nothing is, you know, everything is kind of over-promising and under-delivering. And the good news with all of that is into that decadent void comes Jesus. When everything else is over-promising and under-delivering, you know, we have this firm and steady anchor that holds. Sex, money, power, and technology might all fail us, but Jesus doesn't. And that is just tremendously freeing and calming and good news. And we don't have to freak out when everybody else is freaking out, because we know how the story ends. We know that God is active and in control and good. And all we have to do is, you know, walk in the power of the Holy Spirit. And the good works have already been put and preordained to be, you know, in front of us. And so we just try to seek to walk in obedience. And so we rehearse all of this history to give ourselves some context. There aren't new things under the sun. History does repeat. It is cyclical. It looks a little bit different each time. But, you know, we can look at some of these things in the past, and we can learn from the mistakes that have, you know, kind of gone before us.